Chapter 56. Terry's husband is due back in town today, Rod thought, as he sat down at his desk. It was not a thought that gave him strength to work through a day he knew would be filled with hectic activity. The quarterly reports were due at head office tomorrow morning. In consequence, the entire administration was in its usual last-minute panic. Already there was a mob in the waiting room outside his office that Lily Jordan would soon need a stockwhip to control. At 3 o'clock he was due at a consultants' meeting at head office. But before that, he wanted to go underground to check the drop blast mat that Johnny DeLange had now completed and charged up. The phone went as Lily let in his first visitor. A tall, thin, sorrowful-looking man with a droopy moustache. "Mr. Ironsides," said the voice on the phone.
"Yes."
"Porter's Motors here. I've got an estimate on the repairs to your Maserati."
"How much?"
Rod crossed his fingers.
$1,200.
"Wow!" Rod gasped.
"Do you want us to go ahead?"
"No. I'll have to contact my insurance company first. I'll call you." He hung up. That act of unaccountable vandalism still irked him terribly. He realized that he would be reduced to the company Volkswagen for a further indefinite period. He turned his attention to his visitor. "Detective Inspector Grubbelaar," the tall man introduced himself. "I am investigating officer in the murder of Jose Almeida, the concession store proprietor on this mine."
They shook hands. "Have you any ideas on who did it?" Rod asked.
"We always have got ideas," said the inspector, so sadly that for a moment Rod had the impression that his name was on the list of suspects. "We believe that the murderer is employed by one of the mines in the district, probably the Sonder Ditch. I have called on you to ask for your cooperation in the investigation."
"Of course."
"I will be conducting a great number of interrogations amongst your Bantu employees. I hoped you might find a room for me to use on the premises." Rod lifted his phone, and while he dialed, he told Grubbelaar, "I'm calling our compound manager." Then he transferred his attention to the mouthpiece.
"Ironsides here.
I'm sending an Inspector Grubbelaar down to see you. Please see that an office is placed at his disposal and that he receives full cooperation."
Grubbelaar stood up and extended his hand.
"I won't take up any more of your time. Thank you, Mr. Ironsides." His next visitor was Van der Berg, his personnel officer, brandishing his departmental reports as though they were a winning lottery ticket. "All finished," he announced triumphantly. "All we need is your signature." As Rod uncapped his pen, the telephone squealed again.
"My God," he muttered with pen in one hand and telephone in the other, "is it worth it?"
It was well after 1 o'clock when Rod fled his office, leaving Lily Jordan to hold back the tide. He went directly to Number 1 Shaft, where he was welcomed like the prodigal son by Dimitri and his old line managers. They were all anxious to know who would be replacing him as underground manager. Rod promised to find out that afternoon when he visited head office, and changed into his overalls and helmet. At the spot where David DeLange had died, Rod found a gang fixing a screen of wire mesh over the hanging wall to protect the fuses of his drop blast. The electric cable that carried the blasting circuit to the surface was covered with a distinctive green plastic coating and securely pegged to the roof of the drive. In the concrete blast room at the shaft head, his electrician had already set up a separate control for this circuit. It would be in readiness at all times. He could fire it within minutes. Rod felt as though a great weight had been lifted from his shoulders as he passed through the swinging ventilation doors and tramped on up the drive to speak to Johnny DeLange. Halfway to the face, he met the gigantic figure of Big King coming back towards him with a small gang of lashing boys under his command. Rod greeted him, and Big King stopped and let his gang go on out of earshot before he spoke. "I wish to speak." "Speak, then." Rod noticed suddenly that Big King's face was gaunt. His eyes appeared sunken, and his skin had the dusty, greyish look of sickness, so evident in an ailing Bantu. "I wish to return to my wives in Portuguese Mozambique," said Big King. "Why?" Rod was dismayed at the prospect of losing such a valuable boss boy. "My blood is thin." This was as non-committal an answer as any man has ever received. In essence, it meant, "My reasons are my own, and I have no intention of disclosing them." "When your blood is thick again, will you return to work here?" Rod asked. "That is with the gods." An answer signifying no more than the one preceding it. "I cannot stop you if you wish to go, Big King. You know that," Rod told him. "Report to the compound manager, and he will mark your notice." "I have told the compound manager," said Big King. "He wants me to work out my ticket 33 more days." "Of course," Rod nodded. "You know that it is a contract. You must work it out." "I wish to leave at once," Big King replied stubbornly. "Then you must give me your reason," said Rod. "I cannot let you break contract, except if there is some good reason." Rod knew better than to set a dangerous precedent like that. "There is no reason," Big King admitted defeat. "I will work out the ticket." He left Rod and followed his gang down the drive. Since the night he killed the Portuguese, Big King had slept little and eaten less. Worry had kept his stomach in a turmoil of dysentery. He had neither danced nor sung. Nothing that Crooked Leg nor the Shangaan Induna could say comforted him. He waited for the police to come. As the days passed, so the flesh melted from his body. He knew that they would come before the 33 days of his contract expired. His approach to Rod had been a last despairing effort. Now he was resigned. He knew that the police were inexorable. One day soon they would come. They would lock the silver chains on his wrists and lead him to the closed van. He had seen many men led away like that, and he had heard what happened to them after that. The white man's law was the same as the tribal law of the Shangaans. The taking of life must be paid for with life. They would break his neck with the rope. His ancestors would have crushed his skull with a war club. It was the same in the end. Rod found Johnny DeLange drinking cold tea from his canteen while his gang barred down the face. "How's it going?" he asked. "Well, now we've finished messing about, it has started moving again." Johnny wiped cold tea from his lips and recorked the canteen. "We have broken almost 1,500 feet since Davy died." "That's good going," Rod ignored the reference to the methane explosion and the drop blast mat. Would have been better if Davy were still alive. Johnny disliked Campbell, the miner who had replaced Davy on the night shift. The night shift aren't breaking their fair ground. I'll chase them up, Rod promised. You do that. Johnny turned away to shout an order at his gang. Rod stood and stared at the end of the drive. Less than 1,000 feet ahead lay the dark, hard rock of the Big Dipper. And beyond it? Rod felt his skin creep as he remembered his nightmare. That cold, green, translucent thing waiting for them beyond the dike. All right, Johnny, you're getting close now. Rod tore his imagination away from that green horror. As soon as you hit the Serpentine Rock, you are to stop work immediately and report to me. Is that understood? You better tell that to Campbell also, said Johnny. The night shift may hit the Big Dipper. I'll tell him, Rod agreed. But you make sure you remember. I want to be down here when we hole through the dike. Rod glanced at his watch. It was almost 2 o'clock. He had an hour to get to the consultants' meeting at head office. You are late, Mr. Ironsides. Dr. Manfred Steiner looked up from the head of the boardroom table. My apologies, gentlemen. And Rod took his seat at the long oak table. Just one of those days. The men about the table murmured sympathetic acknowledgement, and Dr. Steiner studied him for a moment without expression, before remarking, I would be obliged for a few minutes of your time after this meeting, Mr. Ironsides. Of course, Dr. Steiner. Good, and Manfred nodded. Now that Mr. Ironsides has graced the table with his presence, the meeting can come to order. It was the closest any of them had ever heard Dr. Steiner come to making a joke. It was dark outside when the meeting ended. The participants shrugged on their coats, made their farewells, and left Manfred and Rod sitting at the table with its overflowing ashtrays and littered pencils and notepads. Manfred Steiner waited for fully 3 minutes after the door had closed on the last person to leave. Rod was accustomed to these long, intent silences, yet he was uneasy. He sensed a new hostility in the man's attitude. He covered his awkwardness by lighting another cigarette and blowing a series of smoke rings at the portrait of Norman Hraski, the original chairman of the company. Flanking Hraski's portrait were two others, one of a slim, blonde man with ravaged good looks and laughing blue eyes. The caption read, Dufford Charleywood, director of CRC from 1867 to 1872. The other portrait, in its heavy gilt frame, depicted an impressively built man with mutton-chop whiskers and black Irish features. Sean Courtney, said the caption, and the dates were the same as Charleywood's. These three had founded the company, and Rod knew a little of their story. They had been as pretty a bunch of rogues as would be found in any convict settlement. Hraski had ruined the other two in an ingenious bear raid on the stock exchange and had virtually stolen their shares in the company. We have become a lot more sophisticated since then, thought Rod. He looked instinctively towards the head of the long table and met Dr. Steiner's level, unblinking stare. Or have we? He wondered. Just what devilment had our friend in mind? Manfred Steiner was examining Rod with detached curiosity. So remote from any emotional rancor was Manfred that he intended using the relationship that had developed between this man and his wife to further the instructions he had received that morning.
"How far is the end of the drive from the dike?" he asked suddenly. "Less than 1,000 feet." "How much longer before you reach it?"
10 days, no more, possibly less."
"As soon as the dike is reached, all work on it must cease immediately. The timing of this is important. Do you understand?"
"I have already instructed my miners not to hold through without my specific orders," said Rod.
"Good."
And Manfred lapsed into silence for another full minute.
Andrew had called him that morning with instructions from the man.
Arnsides was to be well away from the Sonder Ditch when they pierced the dike. It was left to Manfred to engineer his absence.
"I must inform you, Mr. Arnsides, that it will be at least 3 weeks before I give the order to drill through. When you reach the dike, it will be necessary for me to proceed to Europe to make certain arrangements there. I will be away for at least 10 days, during which time no work of any type must be allowed in the drive to the Big Dipper."
"You will be away over Christmas?" Rod asked with surprise.
"Yes."
Manfred nodded and could read Rod's mind. "Terry will be alone," Rod thought quickly. "She will be alone over Christmas." "The Sonder Ditch goes on to essential services only for a full 7 days over Christmas. Just a skeleton crew to keep her going. I could get away for a week. A whole week away together." Manfred waited until he knew that Rod had reached the decision to which he had been steered, and then he asked,
"You understand? You will await my order to hold through. You need not expect that order until the middle of January."
"I understand."
"You may go."
Manfred dismissed him.
"Thanks,"
Rod acknowledged dryly. There was a coffee bar in the ground floor shopping centre of Reef Building. Rod beat a bearded hippie to the telephone booth and dialed the Sandown number. It was safe enough. He had just left Manfred upstairs.
"Theresa Steiner,"
she answered his call.
"We've got a week to ourselves," he told her. "One whole glorious week."
"When?" she demanded joyously. And he told her.
"Where shall we go?" she asked.
"We'll think of somewhere,"